Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Julie and John in their absence. I appreciate that this is not the usual time, and thank you all for showing up despite the odd schedule. So this can be as formal or informal as you guys want. Feel free to shout out questions. The way that I thought to structure this time is really based upon my motivations. I appreciate that at some level these discussions are to introduce you to different fields of research going on here at PI, and so I certainly would like to introduce you to high-energy astrophysics, which is what I spend most of my time doing, but also I have an ulterior motive, not entirely altruistic, and that is to recruit you, because I have a number of interesting projects as a new faculty member, and I would love to have students to work on them, and I understand that you have a SCI project. And so the first half, maybe third today, will be just kind of general high-energy astrophysics stuff. Why would you be interested in doing it? Why do I do it? What is there to do? And then the rest of it will be a brief discussion about what I do, which I know better, and some projects, a pair of projects, which I think would be good for a SCI project. And if you're interested in any of that, of course, you can speak to me today, or you can come find me in the next couple weeks. All right, so let's begin with astrophysics. So astrophysics is concerned with the physics of astronomical phenomena, all right? And that means that it's primarily observational, and that's maybe a little bit different than some of the things you've heard about. Right? There's one universe, you go look at it. You look at the stuff in it. Right? Certainly cosmologists are familiar with that. We don't get to run experiments at the LHC ad infinitum and beat down statistics that way. But another way, we don't have any control over our experimental apparatus. All right, so that means that we're in the rather unenvious problem of simultaneously understanding both our apparatus and our experiment. All right, so that's the downside. That's the bad news. That you have to understand the physical systems that you're looking at, the astronomical systems that you're trying to study, if you want to use them to do anything interesting beyond understanding them. All right. Again, not quite like the LHC, where you think you've understood pretty well the experimental setup. In fact, you spent a lot of time calibrating and adjusting and making it work just right, and then you run the thing for a year and see what you get. On the other hand, so this is the bad news, all right? Let's call it bad news. The good news is the universe is a big place. Okay. Universe is big. I don't think I have to really say that too often. Universe is big. And what do I mean by that? I mean that lots of cool stuff is happening. And lots of cool stuff that we have difficulty doing in a lab is happening in the universe. And so we have all of these opportunities to go learn about physics in regimes that we might not be able to immediately access here. Okay? So when people ask me, what do I do as an astrophysicist? Now, there are really two steps. Okay, the first is to explain and understand astronomical phenomena with what we think we understand physics of. And that's, in some sense, this part, this apparatus business. You see a star, you want to understand how the star works. And mostly you're using standard physics, at least since Beta. We're using standard physics that we more or less understand, quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, hydrodynamics, things like that. Okay. And that's fun, but I wouldn't call it fundamental, right? So maybe fun, but that's it, okay? And there's plenty of interesting things, and the projects that I'll describe are more in this vein, right, at the end. But the real promise, and the thing that I like to hang my hat on, is the possibility of testing fundamental physics using these apparatuses, all right? Using natural experiments. Okay, so that's the goal, but This is your systematic error that you have to beat down. You can't just beat it down with time. Okay, so just to put this another way, I saw Cliff gave a talk. I'm not sure if it was this year, but I saw a bunch of videotaped talks before I came. And he gave a talk in which he rather strongly pushed particle physics. After that talk, you might wonder, why would you ever do anything with particle physics? And for those of you who do particle physics, I guess that's where you are. And for those who don't, maybe you have your own answers. I would say that there are two good reasons. The first is focus. Okay, regardless of whether or not particle physics is going to cover all fundamental physics at some point, right? Philosophy started with watching planets. So there's a traditional focus on looking out, trying to understand what that stuff is. And we all know that more is not more, it's different. So you have your final theory of everything. You know, can you still explain turbulence? Well, maybe in principle, but in practice, there's a long way to go. All right, so focus, but that's kind of the poor answer. Like I said a moment ago, the exciting answer is that there are unique opportunities. Now, I said high-energy astrophysics. I didn't say astrophysics. And if the projector was working, I could show you my title, which is high-energy astrophysics. So it's not terribly unique. But high energy. So what does that mean? Well, my favorite definition is cool. I do high energy astrophysics because it's cool. Really, it's just any energetic process. And the reason why energetic processes are cool is because there's a lot of opportunities for different interesting things to happen. But another way to describe this might be extreme. All right? So, and I'm going to spend a few moments justifying that. More than a few moments justifying that. Extreme physics. All right? Or superlative physics. Or mostest physics. Most and est. So what do I mean by that? I mean things like most massively bound objects in the universe. I mean things like most energetic events in the universe. I mean the most dense things in the universe. Most luminous, strongest magnetic fields. Things like that. These are things that you can't access in the lab, but nature, in all of its bounty, has given them to us. All right. And so I'm going to run through a few of those. And let's... let's do that. All right, so at some point we should have a screen. Oh, the projector's not on yet. Where is the, oh, something just blipped. Okay. Do I need to hit PC or no? Oh, it's over there. Oh, there we go. All right, so you just shut the lights off or turn the lights down. Most of my pictures are going. Oh, that doesn't help. Could we get the projector lowered? God of the time. It is a little eerie, though, isn't it? Well, if you were to look back there, you would see the most massive bound objects in the universe. All right, these are galaxy clusters. All right, so that's Abel 1689. Galaxy clusters. All right, so most massive. All right, so if you wonder what physics is like for something that's 10 to the 15 solar masses, this is your only shot in the universe. But we only have one of those. So cosmologists like to focus on the universe. I think cosmology is great. There's only one. Right, so it's kind of hard to test a lot of what you have to say. There are more than one galaxy cluster. All right, so these are something like, the biggest ones are megaparsec across, million parsecs, millions of light years across, enormous objects, and enormous masses, 10 to 15 solar masses, 1,000 galaxies or so. All right. And not terribly surprising, we're going to get it. They're associated with extraordinarily energetic phenomena. So this is a picture of Sen A. This is a nearby galaxy. It's actually not all that powerful. It's very close, which means we can make these beautiful, or it's possible to make these beautiful mosaic images. And this shows jet lobes. It showed jet lobes. All right. So this is an example of feedback. All right, so most energetic. And we got to get the picture working for bubbles. Who's gone underwater and when they were a kid and blew bubbles? I used to do that to my friends. You try to get underneath them, blow a bunch of bubbles. You don't normally think of those as containing enormous amounts of energy. Can we?
Have to cool down again.
All right. We don't think of them as containing large amounts of energy, but there is an X-ray picture. All right, that's a galaxy cluster. What does it look like? It looks like there's some blob, okay? Very bright in the center. And it's kind of bright around. But there are these two noticeable cavities. All right, this is the most powerful, the most energetic, the largest cavity source we've seen. These are bubbles. These are like those bubbles I blew on my friends at the pool. And in fact, if you go listen to talks by Andy Fabian, he'll open up a book that shows bubble propagation in fluids where people made the biggest bubble they could see what it looked like, and of course it looks like these things. That's probably not a good comparison for lots of microphysical reasons, but they really do look like bubbles. And you can estimate how much energy these bubbles have to have had to clear out the stuff around them. I mean, you can estimate the density and temperature of this stuff just from the emission. And based on that, you know what the pressure was. So you can calculate the PdV work. Okay? The PdV work, all right? And that is 10 to the 62 Ergs. Now I'm going to use a lot of CGS units, and hopefully you're reasonably familiar with those. If you don't know what 10 to the 52 Ergs is, that's 10 to the 8 solar masses. That's the most energetic event, or the most energetic object in the universe since the Big Bang. Suddenly, I'm not sure if it's safe. All right. Okay, but these are very big things, and while this is high energy astrophysics, I'm really a compact object guy. By the way, if you think bubbles are really cool, you should talk to Brian McNamara. He's at Waterloo. He's also an associate here. Or affiliate here, and this is one of his bread and butter topics: is understanding the bubbles and their dynamics. But I'm really a compact object guy. So the next few things are going to be more in line with the kinds of things I do. And that's things like the most dense. All right. The most dense things after, you know, if we throw away singularities, we throw away the Big Bang, throw away the centers of black holes and whatnot, are neutron stars. And those have central densities on the order of 10 times nuclear density, right? So those are enormous nuclei 10 kilometers across. What holds them up? So to understand that in detail, you have to understand what high density nuclear physics looks like. Right? And these are in fact, the only place to understand the high-density limit of nuclear physics. So a lot of nuclear, in fact, one of the first things I did was work at the nuclear theory group at Stony Brook, and they were, at least half of them, obsessed with neutron stars, just calculating neutron star equations of state, trying to fit observations and find out what that meant for what happens when you go to very high densities. All right, what holds them up? We can understand relatively easily what holds them up to zeroth order. It's not radiation pressure. There's no radiation being produced. The whole thing's a big nucleus. There's nowhere for it to go. It's not going to fuse anymore. It's not certainly not going to fission. It's stable. Nothing else in town. So it's not radiation. And thermal pressure is woefully inadequate, and we can demonstrate that in a moment. The answer, you know, people talk about a lot is degeneracy pressure. Who's heard of degeneracy pressure? Okay. It's an interesting name. Because degeneracy pressure is really Heisenberg uncertainty pressure. And degeneracy enters in an important place, but it's not the source of the pressure. You've all seen this. And that's all you really need to do to understand how to hold up a neutron star. You imagine taking a box, specific volume for a particle, and we stick in a neutron. This is a neutron star. And we're trying to squeeze the box. So we're driving delta X down. Okay, uncertainty tells us that means we have less and less constraint on the momentum. All right. So this gives us the delta P, greater than h bar over 2 delta X. All right. So as we squeeze the box, that neutron is ending up some of the time in higher and higher energy states. All right. The energy, if these, so that's true for anything. It's true for bosons, too. Where degeneracy comes into it is that if we have fermions, we have, you know, neutrons are fermions, spin one half, there can be two in any state. If they're fermions, then we can't pack them all into the same state. They all can't all be in the same box. And so with their fermions, the energy of this thing, of this star, which is created out of these cells that we've just packed together, is something like one half, because they're two spins, times n, times delta p, times c. And let's say approximately. Okay? And I can plug this in for delta p. So that's 1/4 times the number of these cells times h bar c over delta x. Okay? But this box was just a specific volume for a neutron. The total volume of whatever object I'm going to make out of these things, and then I'm going to divide it by the number of objects and carve it up into a bunch of equal-sized boxes and stick neutrons in there. So that's 1/4 n h bar c times n over v to the 1/3. Right, the specific volume is delta x cubed. There we go. All right, so the energy. Right, there we go. So let's just leave it at that. The pressure is just what the change in energy is if we squeeze it a little bit. It's a big macroscopic object. We're going to do the classical physics from here on out. All right, and that pressure then is just, let's make sure we get it right, h bar c over 12, n to the 4/3, v to the minus 4/3, right? Or h bar c over 12, n to the 4/3. Now, you might have predicted that. Right? It's like a relativistic gas. Except, what's the temperature of this thing? Anyone want to hazard a guess? What temperature did we assume? If you would have stuck a temperature in this business, where would you have stuck it? A lot of quiet.
Is it something like 10 to the 6 Kelvin or something order?
Oh, that's a interesting guess. Why would you say that?
Oh, well, I worked a bit with neutron stars, and that's the number I remember.
Ah, okay. Well, that might be surface temperature.
Okay.
This is zero temperature. This is pressure without temperature. That's why, yeah, it was a trick question. Sorry. Okay. But nevertheless, it's a relativistic equation of state. All right. What temperature would we need? So let's call this a degeneracy pressure. What temperature would we need in order at nuclear density to have this kind of pressure? Well, the thermal pressure, the ideal gas pressure, NKT, okay? So if we say that's something on the order of this degeneracy pressure, that just gives us that T is equal to H bar C over 12 n to the 1/3 over K. All right? And this is something like 10 to the 11th. All right, so it's certainly not that hot at the centers of neutron stars. So here we have this tiny little microscopic quantum mechanical effect is what holds up neutron stars. Densest things in the universe. All right. They also... Well, I see. That's on, so that's good news. Well, okay.
I'm going to try that from the other end. I'll try the screen.
Okay.
Don't touch anything.
All right. So the dents, they have a lot of pressure. Enormous amount of pressure. That's not that wouldn't necessarily be the hottest thing in the universe, but it's pretty close, 10 to the 11 K. Right. Yes. But because they have such a high pressure, they can also support very, very large magnetic fields. And the formation scheme for these kinds of objects has a lot of turbulence. Yes?
So it's very hot, so it's losing energy.
Oh, no. So it's cold. I mean, it's This is just for comparison. This is how hot you have to be to be like that. But it's zero temperature.
Right.
So we have this zero temperature phenomenon happening at the centers of these astrophysical objects, which, you know, has pressures comparable to something that's a relativistic temperature for a baryon. Not since the Big Bang. Anywhere else. All right. So, but they can support strong magnetic fields. They have a lot of pressure. All right, and that means that we might naively just compare the pressure in a magnetic field to that degeneracy pressure. It turns out that's not a crazy thing to do. I could have compared the energy in a magnetic field to the binding energy. It all has to come out and give you the same answer. when you do that, that's v squared over 8 pi. Okay, we have to plug in numbers to actually get what that would be. The numbers that, the most important number over here, would be that this number density, n, is something like 1 femtometer to the minus 3. Okay, so that's something like 10 to the 39 particles per centimeter cubed. All right. So you can just plug that number in over there and get what the degeneracy pressure is, all right? And when you do that, you get magnetic fields in the order of 10 to the 18. Okay, that's another thing that's just remarkably beyond things that we can do on Earth. The strongest fields we can make on Earth are measured in thousands of Tesla, so 10 to the 7 Gauss. You make those by making a magnet and then imploding it. And for a fraction of a moment, you have high magnetic field, then the whole thing flies apart. Well, these guys hold their magnetic fields. They can hold up to 10 to the 18 Gauss. We don't know if they actually have them, but there are objects that have up to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 Gauss fields on their surface. All right. This is another thing, strongest magnetic fields. So if you're curious about what happens when you have really strong fields, magnetars. It's a special class of neutron stars, they're called. Magnetars are the only place to go look. So strong that they break down the vacuum. If you want to worry about X-ray propagation in the vicinity of these magnetars, you have to worry about the fact that you're constantly breaking down the, you have vacuum polarization. All right? And they're even competitive with the best clocks. Some fraction of these neutron stars are pulsars. So when you have these high densities, I'll say approximately best clocks. Okay. Some fraction are pulsars. Okay, and the characteristic feature that makes this work is that they're compact, right? We have very high densities. So for a kind of a typical mass object that you might guess, something like a solar mass, and we'll show that that has to be roughly what it is, you can get up to Keplerian rotation frequencies, the breakup frequency, the angular frequency the thing can spin at before it starts blowing itself apart, on the order of 6 times 10 to the 3 hertz, okay, kilohertz. So they can really fly. And there are millisecond pulsars out there. And if they have some emission that's localized, you see this thing spinning around, you see a blip every time it comes around to your line of sight. And you can phase lock these things for 25 years. And we know you can do it that long because that's as long as they've been looking. And that's as long as they've known about the millisecond pulsars. All right? And these pulsars, they're very massive. They have very high moments of inertia and very high spin rates, so very large amounts of angular momentum. They're hard to change. They do have glitches and things, but those are modeled pretty well. They're hard to change. You can't just make it turn over on its side. You have many cycles, so that means that over a decade, you get down to Allen variances, variations, precisions comparable to the best atomic clocks. That's why these are the things that people try to use for gravitational wave experiments right now. One of the things they use. All right.
So can I?
Yes.
So a pulsar just, you know, spinning by itself, that's not going to produce gravitational, that's not going to emit gravitational waves.
A pulsar spinning by itself is not going to.
There's going to be something else.
Not going to detect gravitational radiation? Is that what you were?
Well, I mean, is it going to be a significant source of gravitation? I thought that you
no.
too, right?
Right. So if you want to create gravitational waves, you have to have a quadrupole, right? So a spinning axisymmetric object won't do that. They have strong fields. Maybe you can build a mountain. The place where they use them to look for gravitational waves is these. Pulsar timing experiments. So the idea is to have very, very good clocks all around the universe, and you watch for correlations in the changing in the timing signals that come from these clocks. And those correlations correspond to gravitational waves passing by the Earth. Okay, so you're doing an extremely large version of something like LIGO, where you're making this very careful time measurement or equivalently a distance measurement. Okay, but to do that, you have to have really good clocks. They have to be out someplace that is interesting, you know, far enough away, and pulsars do.
And have they detected gravitational waves by doing that?
No. Well, okay. So there's a famous binary, the Hulse-Taylor
right.
binary, right? So this is the one that won the Nobel Prize, right? Okay. And this was they detected the change in the orbital parameters due to gravitational wave emission, but The pulsar gravitational wave experiments are hoping to make direct detections. All right, and brightest. Okay. The brightest objects.
Now, we're so sorry to interrupt, but would you like your screen down or would you like it up?
Why don't you put it down?
Well, we're going to work some magic, and we're going to put it down and turn the projector on. But
then it won't go back up. Is that right?
We can put it back up afterwards.
Okay.
But would you like to do it down, or would you like to stick with the boards, or?
Let's put it down.
You're okay?
Because I have more pictures to show later.
So just making sure.
Yes.
So you can put it down? Yeah. Cool.
This is complicated. All right, brightest. Okay, we already talked about some bright things. We talked about energetic things. Bright things. Another way to look at this is, it's not quite the same, but in this case it's true. Most luminous. All right, and the first example might be a supernova. And we've all heard of supernova. There are a couple different types. One is kind of useful to illustrate just what the limits of this magical degeneracy pressure are. That's these type 1As. Okay, and these are caused by a white dwarf somehow igniting. And one of the possibilities is a single degenerate model where it accretes too much. And why would that matter? Well, let's think about how we would figure out what the structure of an object ought to be. Okay, so we know equilibrium configurations are minimum energy configurations, right? If there's a lower energy state that it can get to, it will get there. All right, so we can start to think about stability just by looking at the total energy of an object. Okay? And that's partially this internal energy. And we computed part of that over here. You know, we estimated what this was way back here. Right here. Okay, so that's this internal energy from degenerate matter. Plus there's gravitational binding energy term. Okay? And the reason why you have bound objects is, of course, because of gravity, because of this term. And so if we were to go off and put these in explicitly, we had something like this, minus g m squared over r. This is all twiddles, because we don't have all the prefactors right. And if I wanted to know if there was a equilibrium configuration, the first thing I would do is I would look for a state in which that was zero. I have a fixed number of particles, right? This m just gets replaced with n p squared. Fixed number of particles, radial configuration. This only thing it depends upon is n and radius. I can just look for minimum energy states. Okay, and I would say, well, this would be an equilibrium state. Ah, excellent. So we're back with the pictures. Here are these bubbles. Right here. That's a real picture. There's a neutron star sitting at the center of a remnant. Lots of questions about what's going on in the interior, although this is the easy part. Here's one of these type 1As. This is Tycho's supernova. Shown in different colors are a bunch of different atomic tracers. I love it because you see all this little structure in there. Clearly some interesting things are happening. All right, so let's look for minimum energy state. So let's plug in what we've already learned about degeneracy pressure. We don't have to do very much there. Okay, just plugging in what we've already learned. We have that this is something like h bar c n to the 4/3 1 over r, right? V to the 1/3, 1 over r. Minus g mp squared over r times n squared. And now we already have a problem, right? Because this r dependence just factors right out. Okay, so dr 1 over r squared times dmp n squared minus h bar c n to the 4/3. There are no minimum energy states. And that's a generic feature of relativistic equations of state. All right, if I have a relativistic gas, it's hard to make bound states. There are no minimum energy states. If this thing is negative, in that sense I have the internal energy dominating the gravitational energy, it wants to explode. And at some point, it gets big enough that the degeneracy, this Heisenberg pressure stuff, become subdominant and you get taken over by thermal pressure or some other such thing. All right, but if it's negative, then you just collapse. There's nothing left, at least this Heisenberg pressure, this degeneracy pressure doesn't stop you anymore. And so that gives you a maximum mass, a maximum number of particles. You get above this number of particles, then you just keep getting squished, you become more and more degenerate, you violate it even more strongly, and you never stop. That's bad news. And that number, we just get by setting this equal to 0, that number is equal to h bar c, or g, mass of the squared to the 3/2. All right? We can make this a little bit nicer. And Planck. All right. So that's the maximum number. Let's call this the maximum mass. There we go. Just multiply number by the number of particles. Right, so that's the maximum mass. And again, you plug in numbers. We know the proton mass. We know what the Planck mass is. And you get that this is about 2 times 10 to the 33 grams. That's a solar mass. So something like a white dwarf can't get much above a solar mass. A white dwarf is exactly like that neutron star case, except it's the electrons that are degenerate. Of course, every electron has a proton buddy. All right, so the proton mass still gravitates. But it's exactly the same story. And if they get bigger than a solar mass, they collapse, become much more dense. Various elements inside the white dwarf begin pressure-driven fusion. And there we have a runaway thermonuclear event, and boom, big explosion. Luminosities are measured in foes. Femtoergs, 10 to the 51 ergs. All right, if you include the neutrinos, I think it's even a couple orders of magnitude higher than that, 10 to the 53 ergs. And that comes out in an hour. Oh, I'm sorry, energy. That's about an hour. All right. So that means that the luminosity is on the order of 10 to the 47 ergs per second. Enormously luminous events. Heard about gamma ray bursts? They're a lot like this. They're about an order of magnitude larger luminosity, somewhat different process. But. The main reason why I want to talk about type 1a is because now there's nothing stopping us. And we end up at my favorite topic, and that's black holes. And some number of these guys end up something like it. This is the crab. This is a different kind of supernova. It's a lot messier. There's the official artist representation of the gamma ray burst. It probably doesn't work like that. All right. Well, instead, let me talk about accretion and black holes. Okay, so GRB is beat that by an order of magnitude, but we could beat it by even more. Accreting black holes. Okay, and in particular, I'm going to be talking about AGN. And at the end of the day, we get luminosities of 10 to the 49 ergs per second. And these are, again, after the Big Bang, the most luminous objects in the universe. And their luminosity comes maybe from a surprising source. It's the fact that they're compact. Okay? It's not that they're massive. Well, at least not yet. Indirectly, because they're massive.
What is AGN?
Active galactic nuclei. All right. These are two examples of AGN. These are supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies that are accreting stuff. And we see them, so they're active. At the centers of galaxies, so the galactic nuclei. Sorry, thank you. All right, they're compact. So if I imagine I have a black hole, I have some stuff that has some mass, that stuff's falling onto my black hole, it's whizzing down. It's just like the penny off the top of the CN Tower. It's faster and faster as it goes down. And it's converting all that gravitational potential energy into kinetic energy. bumps into itself, bumps into neighboring matter, thermalizes some fraction of that. All right. How much energy is being released? Well, that's just assuming that this is small. That's just that, right? Where R is where it stops releasing binding energy. So if it was falling onto a star, this is exactly the same. If it's falling onto a planet, this is exactly the same. All right? I could take the deltas away, put dots, you can have a continuous process, E dot. And then if some fraction of that ends up being radiated, right? This energy is turning into kinetic energy. The kinetic energy can either go into heating stuff up, it can go into accelerating non-thermal particle distributions, it can go into making your favorite particle, it can go into alpha, whatever. But some fraction goes into luminosity, all right? Then I get that this goes in some number, some efficiency times E dot, and that's some efficiency times G M, M dot over R. And again, I haven't said anything about black holes yet. Here's the black hole story. This is why black holes are the brightest things in the universe, despite being black holes. It's because R is really small. All right. So if I plug that in, something on the order of the gravitational radius of the object, gm over c squared, plug that in, that's all I needed. I'm getting out the rest mass. That's why they're bright. And at this stage, there's nothing about the black hole mass. A stellar mass black hole is as good as a supermassive black hole in converting its accreting material into outgoing luminosity. They're incredible engines at all scales. The thing that does care about the mass is feedback, except it's not the feedback that's in vogue now. It's the feedback that was in vogue 100 years ago. What I really mean is the Eddington limit. You might hear this on occasion. The Eddington limit, you have some black hole, it's radiating. I have my stuff coming in, but at the same time, I have photons going out. And they scatter off the stuff. And so I have a radiation force pushing it out. I have a gravitational force pushing it in. And if the radiation gets bright enough, luminous enough, gravity won't win anymore, and you'll blow stuff away. So this is a version of feedback. And you can calculate what luminosity that is. And again, you can go through a process of just comparing these forces. F rad is something like the flux over C times an interaction cross-section, in this case, the Thomson cross-section. Okay, and that's something like L over 4 pi r squared C sigma t. Gravity, Gm over r squared. Times the mass of a proton, so we're talking about the interaction of a single particle. Can everyone see this? Or is this, this is off in the corner. Well, compare these two things, the radius drops out. So it's interesting that this doesn't depend upon the size of the accretion region at all, but it does depend upon the mass. You end up with a maximum luminosity, which is called the Eddington luminosity, 1.3 times 10 to the 38 ergs per second times the mass over the solar mass. Now there's a scale, this cross-section, so now it depends upon mass. Okay, so that's why the brightest objects are massive objects. 10 to the 38 ergs per second times mass in solar masses. To get to 10 to the 49, we need 10 to the 1100 billion solar mass objects, and that's one of them. It's it's close. It's about 10 to the 10 now. There are 10 to the 11 solar mass, almost 10 to the 11 solar mass objects.
What are the energies of the particles involved in these sort of collisions?
That's a good question. So turn that around. Let's ask, what is the temperature of the stuff down near the black hole? Is that what you're asking? Or you mean, what are the photons? These are like ultraviolet and X-ray photons. But the temperatures, remember here we said 10 to the 11 K was really hot. Just backwards.
We don't mean, I'm not sure.
What?
We're not sure if it's which.
Well, this looks like a wrap. There's writing on this. But... okay, so the varial temperature, roughly the temperature attained, 1/6 gm over R, MP. They're all protons. Okay, and that's something like 1/6 MP C squared, and that's something like 10 to the 12 Kelvin. So these are some of the hottest things in the universe. But at 10 to the 12 Kelvin, you emit a lot of X-rays and a lot of UVs. So they're also some of the hottest things. And the other thing, the last superlative, which I spent most of the time talking about, fastest. So you see, there's this funny feature coming out of one of these, right? This thing here. That's one of these AGN. In fact, there's another feature there. There's two examples of AGN jets. There's a lot of them. It's just a handful of them. Some of them are really narrow. They end in these lobes when they're plowing into stuff. Okay, these are some of these. This was Sena A. You already saw that. There's the moon, incidentally. That's how close it is. It's big. And these things, you can see them go. So here's 3C273, here's M87. You can watch them over time, over years, and you can see features move out. And from those features, you can estimate the velocities. And the velocities of these guys have to be ultra-relativistic. So these guys have Lorentz factors of 100, 10 to 100. Okay. And they're not the fastest jets in astrophysics. Those gamma ray bursts, for reasons that we won't have time to talk about, have Lorentz factors. So this is these AGN, these active galactic nuclei. The gamma ray bursts, which I only mentioned in passing, they have Lorentz factors up to 10,000. And these are bulk Lorentz factors. It's not a particle. It's a whole mess of stuff. And these are the fastest, the largest bulk Lorentz factors that we know about. If you like accelerator physics, that's a good place. But of course, the real limit, I mean, I feel a little bit guilty about putting that in. I have to say bulk, right? Because the LHC gets you up to 1 million now. So, okay, fine. But we always have cosmic rays, the ultra high energy cosmic rays. Okay, and those are protons, so they're not as cool. Just a single thing. Protons at zeta electron volts. That's one of those things you've got to look up in the back of your modern physics book to remember. What does zeta mean? It's 10 to the 21 electron volts. Okay. Those are gammas of a trillion. That's the energy that not a fastball. I used to say it's the energy of a fastball, but it's not quite. It's the energy of a slider. But it's not a fastball. And so, well, okay. But it's pretty close, and it's a proton. Extreme physics. Then finally, my favorite thing is the fact that near black holes, we also have extreme gravity. We have nonlinear gravity. So what am I involved in the next 5 minutes? I'm involved in imaging black holes and what we can learn about both gravity and astrophysics based upon imaging these things. Now, what do we expect to see? Imagine you have a horizon, we have some stuff around it, we're watching from some distance. Idealized screen. Okay, obviously, a photon or a trajectory, photons that lie along this trajectory are pitifully lacking. There's just not very much to emit. This is my emitting stuff, starts on the horizon, obviously nothing emitted there, it doesn't go anywhere. And in fact, that might be a little bit dim. Maybe the bottom is better. Okay, these are also similarly dim. There's a magic, not quite magic, a limiting trajectory, which just barely touches the horizon. And any trajectory beyond that whips around it and hits some luminous material again. All right, and that means that I see a shadow or a silhouette. The black hole, and that silhouette's something like 10 gm over c squared across. The nice thing about this, just to keep in mind, is this is a gauge invariant quantity, right? So We don't have to talk about the size of the black hole. I threw in a bunch of GM over C squareds in the calculations I did. They were all Newtonian, so it didn't matter. But if you got all concerned about, wait a minute, GR2M doesn't really mean anything, that would have been a fair consideration. You can do those all right. Here, this is gauge invariant, so I don't even have to do that. And so I'm involved in projects to try to resolve this. And the main problem with that is that this is pitifully small. 10 GM over C squared, there are two main targets for this, Sag A star and M87. Okay, and Sag A star has a mass of something like 4 million solar masses. Okay, but it has an angular diameter, a size here, of something like 53 microarcseconds. Okay, and an arcsecond is 1/200,000th of a radian. It's 10 to the minus 12 radian, pico radian. M87 is a bit bigger. It's almost 10 to the 10 solar masses. But it's something like 40 microarcseconds. It's also a lot further away. And so it's kind of a difficult project. And the main observational constraint is that I'm gonna run over here. The main observational constraint is that these guys are is the diffraction limit. Right, any telescope is fundamentally limited by the fact that it has a finite aperture. And the diffraction limit limits you to angular scales comparable to lambda over d. That is to say, if I have my telescope, I have some diameter for my telescope, and I'm observing at a wavelength lambda, the smallest thing I can see is lambda over d. Okay, for something like Keck, that's 10 milliarcseconds, so that's thousands of times too big. But you can do this with something called radio interferometry.
So what is big?
I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Okay. So for Keck, at a micron, diameters of 10 meters, about 10 milliarcseconds, you can do a lot better in the radio. Even though lambda gets bigger, you can make d bigger. And it's a process called interferometry. I don't really have a lot of time to go into that. But it's right now they're well, for the past 50 years, people have been doing this. Oh, those are more jets. People have been doing this, but at too long a wavelength, just enough to put one pixel across two Sag A stars. Now we can do this with millimeter telescopes, and that's the big difference. So we're going to slightly shorter wavelengths, but we have Earth-sized baselines. So in interferometry, you can think of this as making a measurement in the aperture plane instead of in focusing it first. So you lose out in sensitivity, but you keep resolution. And then you end up with some baseline, and you probe scales with angular scales, lambda over the distance between them. And so then if you have multiple telescopes and you put them really far apart, say on either side of the globe, you make this d, this thing, really big. So even making lambda a little bit larger doesn't hurt you too much. And at a millimeter, this number is something like, we get down to 10 to 20 microarcseconds. Okay? And there are a bunch of telescopes involved. The one complication is each one of these pairs, they don't measure an image. What they measure is a visibility, and the visibility is related to the image by a Fourier transform. And so you have this inversion problem where you're measuring Fourier transform of the image and you have to somehow construct the image from it. And if you only sparsely sample that, that's a difficult process. Nevertheless, things are getting better. This is, say, an input, a theoretical input image from an accretion flow, and this is the reconstructed image if you only have a few stations. The main point is that it really does get better with time, and at some point we're going to be able to make beautiful pictures of black holes. And we've been doing this already by trying to fit things in this Fourier transform plane, fit the observations directly. So we can't reconstruct images yet, but we can compare to the thing that's explicitly measured. So we take some input accretion flow model. You can compute what the image ought to look like after throwing in all of the general relativity and all the plasma physics that you think is relevant. And those pictures depend upon properties of the black hole, properties of the accretion flow. And when you do that, you can go place constraints upon things like the spin magnitude, the direction of spin, and the position angle. So here's a little cartoon showing what that might look like. And this isn't to convince you that any of these limits are important or particularly good yet. They will get a lot better in time. This is a projection of where they're going in the next couple years. That's the parameter space allowed then. That's in the next few years. But that we can do this kind of thing. And we're going to be able to start constraining accretion flow models at least very well in the future, and also potentially deviations from GR. But I wanted to take just a moment, and I have apparently two, to talk a little bit about how we would go beyond this. All right, so the first is, I talked very briefly about accretion. I said something about there being energy being released as stuff falls in. But, you know, people don't normally talk a lot about energy and accretion. And the reason is because we have yet to see the Earth fall into the Sun because it would be energetically favored. And the reason why the Earth isn't falling into the Sun, despite the fact that it would most certainly be energetically favored, right? I mean, it's rather high potential right now, is because we have to worry about angular momentum, right? That is to say, this very simple picture I drew, where we had our box being pulled in by gravity, maybe pulled out by the centrifugal acceleration, or maybe by pressure, and maybe by radiation, all right? Radial force balance isn't enough. We also, you know, the fact that we have the centrifugal acceleration matters, and the fact that we have conservation of angular momentum matters. And so usually the story of accretion is a story about angular momentum transfer. It's about getting the angular momentum from stuff here out there so it can fall in. That's okay, except for the fact that if you estimate, I mean, there is viscosity. Viscosity will do it. If I were to look at this facing downward, okay, I have stuff here whipping around fast, slightly less fast, and slightly slower. So I have this velocity gradient. And if there was viscosity, the viscosity would try to slow this down at the expense of speeding that up, and trying to slow this down at the expense of speeding that up. And you would see this gradient, this transport of angular momentum out just by coupling from viscosity. Okay, so the name of the game at the end of the day is adding viscosity. But the problem with adding viscosity is that if you plug in the molecular viscosity, the viscosity you get in air, for example, just because molecules bump into each other, it's pitifully small. Nothing would ever accrete. This picture is totally fanciful, and black holes don't shine. So instead, typically people say that this is something like a constant times some dimensionally selected parameters, sound speed, disk height. It's a fudge factor. The story behind this is that there's disk turbulence. That I'm not waiting for things to thermally diffuse from one neighboring orbit to the next, but I have on top of this big eddies, which are moving stuff all over the place. And those eddies are mixing up the velocity, they're mixing up the phase space, and I have transport of angular momentum mediated by this turbulence. And in simulations, you sort of see this. This is maybe a low-resolution picture of it, but you see it's certainly not laminar. And in fact, if you add magnetic fields, then you have an extra bit because you have tension along the fields that connects up neighboring streams. However, you know, if you look at this, picture, all of that produces these variations in density. It should also produce variations in the intensity map. And small scale variations in the intensity map. So I showed some nice pictures that look like eclipses. But those probably aren't exactly right because we expect to see this small scale stuff. And that small scale stuff should show up on the very longest baselines. And so the first project that I'd like to, Do you mind if I take another 5 minutes?
Yeah, go on.
All right. The first project that I would suggest is something where we try to look for that, those small scale variations in the emissivity. All right? That is to say, If the density and the magnetic field vary, I expect some emissivity variation, something that goes as a power law. That's kind of a characteristic feature of this of turbulent flows. Everything's a nice power law. Okay? That means I expect a variation in the intensity that goes something like the emissivity over k, right? It's integrated over a distance. All right? And then that means that I expect a power law in the Fourier transform of I, the spatial Fourier transform of I on my map. But of course, this is what we've actually measured. This is what's measured. And you're just getting to the right scales with the longest baselines to start probing what this power law might be. Of course, it's all complicated by the fact that you might have absorption, so it's not optically thin, or you have the lensing, which changes the power spectrum from the stuff behind relative to the stuff in front, and the fact that you're integrating through the flow and all of those things. So it's not quite this simple, but we should, at the largest baselines, be able to see what this turbulence looks like. And that means that we can start checking this fudge factor. We can start checking the standard story of how accretion works and why black holes grow and why they shine, how you get stuff that's moving far away to come down. All right. So the second topic that I would, let's see, which one do I want to kill now? In the second topic, so that's one, looking at turbulence, trying to constrain. Now I'm the problem. All right, so looking at trying to probe MHD turbulence, which is something that people have been doing with simulations quite a bit, but nobody has been able to do properly observationally in the black hole systems where it's always in. Exactly. Okay, the other thing is, you know, those observations that I showed you, the data analysis, I've zipped through very, very quickly. I showed some posterior probability distributions. This stuff, that's what's expected, but that's what we have right now. These come from a set of observations that span timescales from 10 seconds to 2 years. So each little data point they took was taken over 10 seconds, and they took data on epochs that were separated by 2 years. And you can fit the same model to everything. And that's a little surprising, actually. I mean, it's how we beat down a lot of errors, but that's a little surprising. And the surprising fact about it is that we see sources like this. This is SS-433. This is one of these famous microquasars. 433. And it shows this helical pattern of stuff. And the reason is because it's precessing. We see stuff come out here, you know, and it's just like taking the water hose and spinning it around. You eject stuff in this direction, and then it precesses, and you eject stuff in this direction, precesses. All right, and you see the corkscrew. And so if I were to see a precessing source, so imagine here's our black hole, here's our accretion donut, this side's coming towards me, so I see an image that looks like that. And then I wait a little bit, and this thing, so the black hole maybe has spin that way, but the disk has spin in some other angular momentum in another direction, and so they're going to precess around each other, and the disk around the black hole. Then at some later time, looks something like this. Okay, and at some later time yet, looks like this. And you'll notice that the image wobbles. Starts off up here, ends up here, and then comes down there. And so the fact that I was able to fit with the exact same model, and by that I mean the same orientation and everything, is a little surprising. It means that there was no precession. Well, maybe there was. The data wasn't that great yet. But it will be much better. We'll be able to distinguish exactly these possibilities. All right? And there are reasons to think that it ought to precess. I mean, aside from things like SS-433, the first is that the time scale for stuff to accrete on something like Sagittarius Star is much shorter than the Lenz-Therian time, Lenz-Therian angular velocity, right up down to very near the horizon. So you expect stuff to not align. Right? I mean, you might have worried that if I had a black hole like this and a disk like this, that I would get, black hole like this and a disk like this. I get a warp that will align the disk. It's Bardeen-Petterson. But it doesn't happen for these kinds of accretion flows. This only happens when you have a very slowly infalling flow. And then how big this warp is dependent upon how slow it is. But these big, thick disks, they fall in right away. And so this warp is very small. So you would have expected to see this just from Bardeen-Petterson. The other reason is that maybe the precession time is just really long. And you can kind of estimate that now. You know how much angular momentum is in the disk. It turns out it's dominated by stuff far away. And you know what the torque applied by frame dragging is, at least lens theory, but you could provide other torques. And when you do that, you get that the precession time, okay, is something like 10 to the 7 seconds times 1 over spin times an angular difference times, so this is this R warp. This is this thing. And it's in units of gm over c squared times R outer over 10 to the 3. R outer is the distance to the very outside edge of the disk. Okay? Remember, angular momentum is dominated. It's dominated by stuff far away. So if you make the disk bigger, it's got more angular momentum, it's hard to bend, it's hard to turn. Because the accretion time is so short, the precession time is subdominant right up until the very center, I have to tilt the whole disk at the same time. So big disks, large angular momentum, difficult to precess. But 10 to the 7 seconds is 4 months. That's less than 2 years. All right. So we can start talking about the torques that are acting on things near the black hole, the center of the galaxy. Amongst them is this lens theory precession. Try to do a poor man's gravity probe B. We can also look at massive perturbers. So that's the next project, is to look at sources of precession inside J star and ask just how well we can limit those. How big do we expect each one to be? This is already an interesting size for the disk. So this is kind of what people normally talk about. So we're already at that point. All right, thank you for giving me a little bit of extra time. Any questions? You can find me around here. The next couple weeks are a little hectic, but after that, almost half the time. Look me up on the webpage, A. Broderick at Perimeter. And thank you very much.